Smoke came whirling through the crevices in the rock, so foul-smelling that Atreyu could hardly breathe. Once the luck dragon managed to bite off one of the monster's long legs. But instead of falling into the chasm, the severed leg hovered for a time in mid-air, then returned to its old place in the black cloud body. And several times the dragon seemed to seize one of the monster's limbs between its teeth, but bit into the void. Only then did Atreyu notice that the monster was not a single solid body, but was made up of innumerable small steel-blue insects, which buzzed like angry hornets. It was their compact swarm that kept taking different shapes. This was Yggdrasil. And now Atreyu knew why she was called the Many. He sprang from his hiding place, reached for the gem, and shouted at the top of his lungs, "Stop! In the name of the Childlike Empress, stop!" But the hissing and roaring of the combatants drowned out his voice. He himself could barely hear it. Without stopping to think, he set foot on the sticky ropes of the web, which swayed beneath him as he ran. He lost his balance, fell, clung by his hands to keep from falling into the dark chasm, pulled himself up again, caught himself in the ropes, fought free, and hurried on. At last, Yggdrasil sensed that something was coming toward her. With the speed of lightning, she turned about, confronting Atreyu with an enormous steel-blue face. Her single eye had a vertical pupil, which stared at Atreyu with inconceivable malignancy. A cry of fear escaped Bastion. A cry of terror passed through the ravine and echoed from side to side. Yggdrasil turned her eye to left and right to see if someone else had arrived, but that sound could not have been made by the boy who stood there as though paralyzed with horror. Could she have heard my cry? Bastion wondered in alarm. But that's not possible. And then Atreyu heard Igramul's voice. It was very high and slightly hoarse, not at all the right kind of voice for that enormous face. Her lips did not move as she spoke. It was the buzzing of a great swarm of hornets that shaped itself into words. "Her two legs," Atreyu heard. "Years upon years of hunger, and now two tasty morsels at once. A lucky day for Yggdrasil." Atreyu needed all his strength to keep his composure. He held the gem up to the monster's one eye and asked, "Do you know this emblem?" "Come closer, two legs," buzzed the many voices. "Yggdrasil doesn't see well." Atreyu took one step closer to the face. The mouth opened, showing innumerable glittering feelers, hooks, and claws, in place of a tongue. "Still closer," the swarm buzzed. He took one more step, which brought him near enough to distinguish the innumerable steel-blue insects which whirled around in seeming confusion. Yet the face as a whole remained motionless. "I am Atreyu," he said. "I have come on a mission from the Childlike Empress."
"Most inopportune," said the angry buzzing after a time. "What do you want of Yggdrasil? As you can see, she is very busy."
"I want this luck dragon," said Atreyu. "Let me have him."
"What do you want him for, Atreyu Two Legs?"
"I lost my horse in the swamps of sadness. I must go to the southern oracle, because only Uyulala can tell me who can give the Childlike Empress a new name. If she doesn't get one, she will die, and all Fantastica with her. You too, Yggdrasil."
"Ah," the face drawled, "is that the reason for all the places where there is nothing?"
"Yes," said Atreyu. "So you too know of them. But the southern oracle is too long a journey for a lifetime. That's why I'm asking you for this luck dragon. If he carries me through the air, I may get there before it's too late.
Out of the whirling swarm that made up the face came a sound suggesting the giggling of many voices.
You're all wrong, Atreyu Two Legs. We know nothing of the Southern Oracle, and nothing of Uyulala. But we do know that this dragon cannot carry you, and even if he were in the best of health, the trip would take so long that the childlike empress would die of her illness in the meantime. You must measure your quest, Atreyu, in terms not of your own life, but of hers.
The gaze of the eye with the vertical pupil was almost unbearable.
That's true, he said in a small voice. Besides, the motionless face went on, the luck dragon has Igrimul's poison in his body. He has less than an hour to live.
Then there's no hope, Atreyu murmured. Not for him, not for me, and not for you either, Igrimul.
Oh, well, the voice buzzed. Igrimul would at least have had one good meal. But who says it's Igrimul's last meal? She knows a way of getting you to the Southern Oracle in a twinkling. But the question is, will you like it?
What is the way?
That is Igrimul's secret. The creatures of darkness have their secrets too, Atreyu Two Legs. Igrimul has never revealed hers. And you too must swear you'll never tell a soul, for it would be greatly to Igrimul's disadvantage if it were known. Yes, greatly to her disadvantage.
I swear, speak! The great steel-blue face leaned forward just a little and buzzed almost inaudibly.
You must let Igrimul bite you.
Atreyu shrank back in horror.
Igrimul's poison, the voice went on, kills within an hour. But to one who has it inside him, it gives the power to wish himself in any part of Fantastica he chooses. Imagine if that were known. All Igrimul's victims would escape her.
An hour? Cried Atreyu. What can I do in an hour?
Well, buzzed the swarm, at least it's more than all the hours remaining to you here.
Atreyu struggled with himself. Will you set the luck dragon free if I ask it in the name of the childlike empress? He finally asked.
No, said the face. You have no right to ask that of Igrimul, even if you are wearing Orin, the gem. The childlike empress takes us all as we are. That is why Igrimul respects her emblem.
Atreyu was still standing with bowed head. Igrimul had spoken the truth. He couldn't save the white luck dragon. His own wishes didn't count. He looked up and said,
Do what you suggested.
Instantly, the steel-blue cloud descended on him and enveloped him on all sides. He felt a numbing pain in the left shoulder. His last thought was, To the Southern Oracle. Then the world went black before his eyes. When the wolf
reached the spot a short time later, he saw the giant spider web, but there was no one in sight. There, the trail he had been following broke off, and try as he might, he could not find it again. Bastian stopped reading. He felt miserable, as though he himself had Igrimal's poison inside him. "Thank God I'm not in Fantastica," he muttered. "Luckily, such monsters don't exist in reality. Anyway, it's only a story." But was it only a story? How did it happen that Igrimal, and probably Atreyu as well, had heard Bastian's cry of terror? Little by little, this book was beginning to give him a spooky feeling. 5. The Gnomics. Ever so slowly, Atreyu awoke to the world. He saw that he was still in the mountains, and for a terrible moment he suspected that Igrimal had deceived him. But these, he soon realized, were entirely different mountains. They seemed to consist of great rust-red blocks of stone piled in such a way as to form strange towers and pyramids. In between these structures, the ground was covered with bushes and shrubbery. The air was blazing hot. The country was bathed in glaring sunlight. Shading his eyes with his hand, Atreyu looked around him and discovered about a mile away an irregularly shaped arch, perhaps 100 feet high. It, too, appeared to consist of piled stone blocks. Could that be the entrance to the southern oracle? As far as he could see, there was nothing behind the arch, only an endless, empty plain, no building, no temple, no grove. Nothing suggesting an oracle. Suddenly, while he was wondering what to do, he heard a deep, bronze-like voice.
"Atreyu!"
And then again,
"Atreyu!"
Turning around, he saw the white luck dragon emerging from one of the rust-red towers. Blood was pouring from his wounds, and he was so weak he could barely drag himself along.
"Here I am, Atreyu," he said, merrily winking one of his ruby-red eyes. "And you needn't be so surprised. I was pretty well paralyzed when I was caught in that spider web, but I heard everything Igrimal said to you. So I thought to myself, she has bitten me too, after all, so why shouldn't I take advantage of the secret as well? That's how I got away from her."
Atreyu was overjoyed. "I hated leaving you to Igrimal," he said, "but what could I do?"
"Nothing," said the luck dragon. "You've saved my life all the same, even if I had something to do with it."
And again he winked, this time with the other eye. "Saved your life," Atreyu repeated, "for an hour. That's all we have left. I can feel Igrimal's poison burning my heart away."
"Every poison has its antidote," said the white dragon. "Everything will turn out all right. You'll see."
"I can't imagine how," said Atreyu.
"Neither can I," said the luck dragon. "But that's the wonderful part of it. From now on you'll succeed in everything you attempt, because I'm a luck dragon. Even when I was caught in the web, I didn't give up hope. And as you see, I was right."
Atreyu smiled. "Tell me, why did you wish yourself here, and not in some other place where you might have been cured?"
"My life belongs to you," said the dragon, "if you'll accept it. I thought you'd need a mount for this great quest of yours, and you'll soon see that crawling around the country on 2 legs, or even galloping on a good horse, can't hold a candle to whizzing through the air on the back of a luck dragon. Are we partners?"
"We're partners," said Atreyu.
"By the way," said the dragon, "my name is Falcor."
"Glad to meet you," said Atreyu. "But while we're talking, what little time we have left is seeping away. I've got to do something.
But what?
Have luck, said Falcor. What else?
But Atreyu heard no more. He had fallen down and lay motionless in the soft folds of the dragon's body. Igrimal's poison was taking effect. When Atreyu, no one knows how much later, opened his eyes again, he saw nothing but a very strange face bent over him. It was the wrinkliest, shriveledest face he had ever seen, and it was only about the size of a fist. It was as brown as a baked apple, and the eyes in it glittered like stars. The head was covered with a bonnet made of withered leaves. Atreyu felt a little drinking cup held to his lips.
"Nice medicine, good medicine," mumbled the wrinkled little lips in the shriveled face. "Just drink, child. Do you good?"
Atreyu sipped. It tasted strange, kind of sweet and sour. Atreyu found it painful to speak. "What about the white dragon?" he asked.
"Doing fine," the voice whispered. "Don't worry, my boy. You'll get well. You'll both get well. The worst is over. Just drink, drink."
Atreyu took another swallow, and again sleep overcame him. But this time it was the deep, refreshing sleep of recovery. The clock in the belfry struck 2. Bastian couldn't hold it in any longer. He simply had to go. He had felt the need for quite some time, but he hadn't been able to stop reading. Besides, he had been afraid to go downstairs. He told himself that there was nothing to worry about, that the building was deserted, that no one would see him. But still he was afraid, as if the school were a person watching him. But in the end, there was no help for it. He just had to go. He set the open book down on the mat, went to the door, and listened with pounding heart. Nothing. He slid the bolt and slowly turned the big key in the lock. When he pressed the handle, the door opened, creaking loudly. He padded out in his stocking feet, leaving the door behind him open to avoid unnecessary noise. He crept down the stairs to the second floor. The student's toilet was at the other end of the long corridor with the spinach-green classroom doors. Racing against time, Bastian ran as fast as he could and just made it. As he sat there, he wondered why heroes in stories like the one he was reading never had to worry about such problems. Once, when he was much younger, he had asked his religion teacher if Jesus Christ had had to go like an ordinary person. After all, he had taken food and drink like everyone else. The class had howled with laughter, and the teacher, instead of an answer, had given him several demerits for insolence. He hadn't meant to be insolent. "Probably," Bastian now said to himself, "these things are just too unimportant to be mentioned in stories." Yet for him they could be of the most pressing and embarrassing importance. He was finished. He pulled the chain and was about to leave when he heard steps in the corridor outside. One classroom door after another was opened and closed, and the steps came closer and closer. Bastian's heart pounded in his throat. Where could he hide? He stood glued to the spot, as though paralyzed. The washroom door opened, luckily in such a way as to shield Bastian. The janitor came in. One by one, he looked into the stalls. When he came to the one where the water was still running and the chain swaying a little, he hesitated for a moment and mumbled something to himself. But when the water stopped running, he shrugged his shoulders and went out. His steps died away on the stairs. Bastian hadn't dared breathe the whole time, and now he gasped for air. He noticed that his knees were trembling. As fast as possible, he padded down the corridor with the spinach-green doors, up the stairs, and back into the attic.
Only when the door was locked and bolted behind him did he relax. With a deep sigh, he settled back on his pile of mats, wrapped himself in his army blankets, and reached for the book. When Atreyu woke for the second time, he felt perfectly rested and well. He sat up. It was night. The moon was shining bright, and Atreyu saw he was in the same place where he and the white dragon had collapsed. Falkor was still lying there. His breathing came deep and easy, and he seemed to be fast asleep. His wounds had been dressed. Atreyu noticed that his own shoulder had been dressed in the same way, not with cloth, but with herbs and plant fiber. Only a few steps away, there was a small cave, from which issued a faint beam of light. Taking care not to move his left arm, Atreyu stood up cautiously and approached the cave. Bending down, for the entrance was very low, he saw a room that looked like an alchemist's workshop in miniature. At the back, an open fire was crackling merrily. Crucibles, retorts, and strangely shaped flasks were scattered all about. Bundles of dried plants were piled on shelves. A little table in the middle of the room and the other furniture seemed to be made out of root wood, crudely nailed together. Atreyu heard a cough, and then he saw a little man sitting in an armchair by the fire. The little man's hat had been carved from a root and looked like an inverted pipe bowl. The face was as brown and shriveled as the face Atreyu had seen leaning over him when he first woke up. But this one was wearing big eyeglasses, and the features seemed sharper and more anxious. The little man was reading a big book that was lying in his lap. Then a second little figure, which Atreyu recognized as the one that had bent over him, came waddling out of another room. Now Atreyu saw that this little person was a woman. Apart from her bonnet of leaves, she, like the man in the armchair, was wearing a kind of monk's robe, which also seemed to be made of withered leaves. Humming merrily, she rubbed her hands and busied herself with the kettle that was hanging over the fire. Neither of the little people would have reached up to Atreyu's knee. Obviously they belonged to the widely ramified family of the gnomes, though to a rather obscure branch.
"Woman," said the little man testily, "get out of my light. You are interfering with my research."
"You and your research," said the woman. "Who cares about that? The important thing is my health elixir. Those two outside are in urgent need of it."
"Those two," said the man irritably, "will be far more in need of my help and advice."
"Maybe so," said the little woman, "but not until they are well. Move over, old man."
Grumbling, the little man moved his chair a short distance from the fire. Atreyu cleared his throat to call attention to his presence. The two gnomes looked around.
"He's already well," said the little man. "Now it's my turn."
"Certainly not," the little woman hissed. "He'll be well when I say so. It'll be your turn when I say it's your turn."
She turned to Atreyu.
"We would invite you in, but it's not quite big enough, is it? Just a moment. We shall come out to you."
Taking a small mortar, she ground something or other into a powder, which she tossed in the kettle. Then she washed her hands, dried them on her robe, and said to the little man,
"Stay here until I call you, Enkiwook. Understand?"
"Yes, Urgle, I understand," the little man grumbled. "I understand only too well."
The female gnome came out of the cave and looked up at Atreyu from under knitted brows.
"Well, well, we seem to be getting better, don't we?"
Atreyu nodded. The gnome climbed up on a rocky ledge, level with Atreyu's face, and sat down.
"No pain?" she asked.
"None worth mentioning," Atreyu answered.
"Nonsense," the old woman snapped. "Does it hurt or doesn't it?"
"It still hurts," said Atreyu, "but it doesn't matter."
"Not to you, perhaps, but it does to me. Since when does the patient tell the doctor what matters? What do you know about it? If it's to get well, it has to hurt. If it stopped hurting, your arm would be dead.
I'm sorry, said Atreyu, who felt like a scolded child. I only wanted to say, that is, I wanted to thank you.
What for? Said Urgle impatiently. I'm a healer, after all. I've only done my professional duty. Besides, Enkiwook, that's my old man, saw the glory hanging on your neck. So what would you expect?
What about Falcor? Atreyu asked. How's he getting along?
Falcor? Who's that?
The White Luck Dragon.
Oh, I don't know yet. Took a little more punishment than you. But then he's bigger and stronger, so he ought to make it.
Why not?
He needs a little more rest. Where did you ever pick up that poison? And where have you come from all of a sudden? And where are you going? And who are you in the first place?
Enkiwook was standing in the mouth of the cave. He listened as Atreyu answered Urgle's questions. When Urgle opened her mouth to speak again, he shouted,
Hold your tongue, woman. Now it's my turn.
Removing his pipe-bowl hat, he scratched his bald head and said,
Don't let her tone bother you, Atreyu. Old Urgle is a little crude, but she means no harm. My name is Enkiwook. We are the well-known gnomics. Ever hear of us?
No, Atreyu confessed. Enkiwook seemed rather offended.
Oh, well, he said. Apparently you don't move in scientific circles, or someone would undoubtedly have told you that you couldn't find a better advisor than yours truly if you're looking for Uyulala in the Southern Oracle. You've come to the right address, my boy. Don't give yourself airs, Urgle broke in.
Then she climbed down from her ledge, and grumbling to herself, vanished into the cave. Enkiwook ignored her comment.
I can explain everything, he went on. I've studied the question all my life, inside and out. I set up my observatory just for that. I'm in the last stage of a great scientific work on the Oracle. The riddle of Uyulala solved by Professor Enkiwook. That's the title. Sounds all right, doesn't it? To be published in the very near future. Unfortunately, a few details are still lacking. You can help me, my boy.
An observatory? Asked Atreyu, who had never heard the word. Enkiwook nodded, and beaming with pride, motioned Atreyu to follow him. A narrow path twined its way upward between great stone blocks. In some places where the grade was especially steep, tiny steps had been cut out of the stone. Of course, they were much too small for Atreyu's feet, and he simply stepped over them. Even so, he had a hard time keeping up with the gnome.
Bright moonlight tonight, said Enkiwook. You'll see them all right.
See who? Atreyu asked. Uyulala? Enkiwook only frowned and shook his head. At last, they came to the top of the hill. The ground was flat, but on one side there was a natural stone parapet. In the middle of this wall there was a hole, obviously the work of gnomian hands, and behind the hole, on a stand made of rootwood, stood a small telescope. Enkiwook looked through the telescope and made a slight adjustment by turning some screws. Then he nodded with satisfaction and invited Atreyu to look. To put himself on a level with it, Atreyu had to lie down on the ground and prop himself on his elbows. The telescope was aimed at the great stone arch, or more specifically, at the lower part of the left pillar. And beside this pillar, as Atreyu now saw, an enormous sphinx was sitting motionless in the moonlight. The forepaws on which she was propped were those of a lion. The hindquarters were those of a bull. On her back she bore the wings of an eagle, and her face was that of a human woman, in form at any rate, for the expression was far from human. It was hard to tell whether this face was smiling, or whether it expressed deep grief or utter indifference. After looking at it for some time, Atreyu seemed to see abysmal wickedness and cruelty. But a moment later he had to correct his impression, for he found only unruffled calm.
Don't bother.
He heard the gnome's deep voice in his ear.
You won't solve it. It's the same with everyone.
I've observed it all my life, and I haven't found the answer. Now for the other one."
He turned one of the screws. The image passed the opening of the arch, through which one saw only the empty plain. Then the right-hand pillar came into Atreyu's view, and there, in the same posture, sat a second sphinx. The enormous body shimmered like liquid silver in the moonlight. She seemed to be staring fixedly at the first, just as the first was gazing fixedly at her.
"Are they statues?"
asked Atreyu, unable to avert his eyes.
"Oh, no," said Engiwook with a giggle. "They are real-life sphinxes, very much alive. You've seen enough for now. Come, we'll go down. I'll explain everything."
And he held his hand in front of the telescope, so that Atreyu could see no more. Neither spoke on the way back. 6. The Three Magic Gates. Falkor was still sound asleep when Engiwook brought Atreyu back to the gnome's cave. In the meantime, Urgle had moved the little table into the open and put on all sorts of sweets and fruit and herb jellies. There were also little drinking cups and a pitcher of fragrant herb tea. The table was lit by 2 tiny oil lamps.
"Sit down," Urgle commanded. "Atreyu must eat and drink something to give him strength. Medicine alone is not enough."
"Thank you," said Atreyu. "I'm feeling fine already."
"No back talk," Urgle snapped. "As long as you're here, you'll do as you're told. The poison in your body has been neutralized, so there's no need to hurry, my boy. You've all the time you need. Just take it easy."
"It's not on my account," said Atreyu, "but the child-like Empress is dying. Even now, every hour may count."
"Rubbish," the old woman grumbled. "Haste makes waste. Sit down, eat, drink." "Better give in," Engiwook whispered. "I know the woman from A to Z. When she wants something, she gets it. Besides, you and I have a lot to talk about."
Atreyu spotted cross-legged at the tiny table and fell to. Every bite and every swallow made him feel as if warm, golden life were flowing into his veins. Only then did he notice how weak he had been. Bastian's mouth watered. It seemed to him that he could smell the aroma of the gnome's meal. He sniffed the air, but of course it was only imagination. His stomach growled audibly. In the end, he couldn't stand it any longer. He took his apple and the rest of his sandwich out of his satchel and ate them both. After that, though far from full, he felt a little better. Then he realized that this was his last meal. The word "last" terrified him. He tried not to think of it.
"Where did you get all these good things?" Atreyu asked Urgle. "Ah, Sunny," he said, "it takes a lot of running around to find the right plants. But he, this knuckle-headed Engiwook of mine, insists on living here because of his all-important studies. Where the food is to come from is the least of his worries."
"Woman," said Engiwook with dignity, "how would you know what's important and what isn't? Be off with you now, and let us talk."
Mumbling and grumbling, Urgle withdrew into the little cave, and a moment later Atreyu heard a great clatter of pots and pans.
"Don't mind her," said Engiwook under his breath. "She's a good old soul. She just needs something to grumble about now and then." "Listen to me, Atreyu. I'm going to let you in on a few things you need to know about the Southern Oracle. It's not easy to get to Uyulala. In fact, it's rather difficult. But I don't want to give you a scientific lecture. Maybe it would be better if you ask questions. I tend to lose myself in details. Just fire away."
"All right," said Atreyu.
"Who or what is Uyulala?"
Engiwook gave him an angry look.
"Botheration," he spluttered. "You're so blunt, so direct, just like my old woman. Couldn't you start with something else?
Atreyu thought a while. Then he asked, That big stone gate with the sphinxes, is that the entrance?
That's better, said Engiwook. Now we'll get somewhere. Yes, that gate is the entrance, but then come two more gates, and Uyulala's home is behind the third, if one can speak of her having a home.
Have you yourself ever been with her?
Don't be absurd, replied Engiwook, again somewhat nettled. I am a scientist. I have collected and collated the statements of all the individuals who have been there. The ones who have come back, that is. Very important work. I can't afford to take personal risks. It could interfere with my work.
I see, said Atreyu. Now what about these three gates?
Engiwook stood up, folded his hands behind his back, and paced.
The first, he lectured, is known as the Great Riddle Gate. The second is the Magic Mirror Gate, and the third is the No Key Gate.
Strange, Atreyu broke in. As far as I could see, there was nothing behind that stone gate but an empty plain. Where are the other gates?
Be still, Engiwook scolded. How can I make myself clear if you keep interrupting? It's very complicated. The second gate isn't there until a person has gone through the first, and the third isn't there until the person has the second behind him. And Uyulala isn't there until he has passed through the third. Simply not there. Do you understand?
Atreyu nodded, but preferred to say nothing, for fear of irritating the gnome.
Through my telescope you have seen the first, the Great Riddle Gate, and the two sphinxes. That gate is always open, obviously. There's nothing to close. But even so, no one can get through.
Here Engiwook raised a tiny forefinger.
Unless the sphinxes closed their eyes. And do you know why? The gaze of a sphinx is different from the gaze of any other creature. You and I and everyone else, our eyes take something in. We see the world. A sphinx sees nothing. In a sense, she is blind. But her eyes send something out. And what do her eyes send out? All the riddles of the universe. That's why these sphinxes are always looking at each other. Because only another sphinx can stand the sphinx's gaze. So try to imagine what happens to one who ventures into the area where those two gazes meet. He freezes to the spot, unable to move, until he has solved all the riddles of the world. If you go there, you'll find the remains of those poor devils.
But, said Atreyu, didn't you say that their eyes sometimes close? Don't they have to sleep now and then?
Sleep?
Engiwook was shaken with giggles.
Goodness gracious, a sphinx asleep? I should say not. You really are an innocent. Still, there's some point to your question. All my research, in fact, hinges on that particular point. The sphinxes shut their eyes for some travellers and let them through. The question that no one has answered up until now is this. Why one traveller and not another? Because you mustn't suppose they let wise, brave, or good people through and keep the stupid, cowardly, and wicked out. Not a bit of it. With my own eyes, I've seen them admit stupid fools and treacherous knaves, while decent, sensible people have given up after being kept waiting for months. And it seems to make no difference whether a person has some serious reason for consulting the Oracle or whether he's just come for the fun of it.
Haven't your investigations suggested some explanation? Atreyu asked.
Angry flashes darted from Engiwook's eyes.
Have you been listening or haven't you? Didn't I just say that so far no one has answered that question? Of course, I've worked up a few theories over the years. At first I thought the Sphinx's judgment might be guided by certain physical characteristics, size, beauty, strength, and so on. But I soon had to drop that idea.
Then I toyed with numerical patterns. The idea, for instance, that 3 out of 5 were regularly excluded, or that only prime-numbered candidates were admitted. That worked pretty well for the past, but for forecasting it was no use at all. Since then I've come to the conclusion that the Sphinx's decision is based on pure chance, and that no principle whatever is involved. But my wife calls my conclusion scandalous, unfantastican, and absolutely unscientific. Are you starting your old nonsense again? Came Urgle's angry voice from the cave. Shame on you. Such scepticism only shows that the bitter brain you once had has dried up on you. Hear that? Said Engiwook with a sigh. And the worst of it is that she's right. What about the childlike Empress's amulet? Atreyu asked. Do you think they'll respect it? They too are natives of Fantastica, after all. Yes, I suppose they are, said Engiwook, shaking his apple-sized head. But to respect it, they'd have to see it. And they don't see anything. But their gaze would strike you. And I'm not so sure the Sphinxes would obey the childlike Empress. Maybe they are greater than she is. I don't know. I don't know. Anyway, it's most worrisome. Then what do you advise? Atreyu asked. You will have to do what all the others have done. Wait and see what the Sphinxes decide, without hoping to know why.
Atreyu nodded thoughtfully. Urgle came out of the cave. In one hand she held a bucket with some steaming liquid in it, and under her other arm she was carrying a bundle of dried plants. Muttering to herself, she went to the Luck Dragon, who was still lying motionless, fast asleep. She started climbing around on him and changing the dressings on his wounds. Her enormous patient heaved one contented sigh and stretched. Otherwise, he seemed unaware of her ministrations.
"Couldn't you make yourself a little useful?"
she said to Engiwook as she was hurrying back to the kitchen.
"Instead of sitting around like this talking rubbish?" "I am making myself extremely useful," her husband called after her. "Possibly more useful than you. But that's more than a simple-minded woman like you will ever understand."
Turning to Atreyu, he went on,
"She can only think of practical matters. She has no feeling for the great, overarching ideas."
The clock in the belfry struck 3. By now, Bastian's father must have noticed, if he was ever going to, that Bastian hadn't come home. Would he worry? Maybe he'd go looking for him. Maybe he'd already notified the police. Maybe calls had gone out over the radio. Bastian felt a sick pain in the pit of his stomach. But if the police had been notified, where would they look for him? Could they possibly come to this attic? Had he locked the door when he came back from the toilet? He couldn't remember. He got up and checked. Yes, the door was locked and bolted. Outside, the November afternoon was drawing to a close. Ever so slowly, the light was failing. To steady his nerves, Bastian paced the floor for a while. Looking about him, he discovered quite a few things one wouldn't have expected to find in a school. For instance, a battered old Victrola with a big horn attached. God only knew when and by whom it had been brought here. In one corner there were some paintings in ornate gilt frames. They were so faded that hardly anything could be made out. Only here and there a pale, solemn-looking face that shimmered against a dark background. And then there was a rusty, 7-armed candelabrum, still holding the stumps of thick wax candles, bearded with drippings. Bastian gave a sudden start, for looking into a dark corner, he saw someone moving. But when he looked again, it dawned on him that he had only seen himself, reflected in a large mirror that had lost half its silvering. He went closer and looked at himself for a while. He was really nothing much to look at, with his pudgy build and his bow legs and pasty face. He shook his head and said aloud, "No!" Then he went back to his mats. By then it was so dark that he had to hold the book up to his eyes.
"Where were we?" Engiwook asked.
at the Great Riddle Gate,
Atreyu reminded him.
Right. Now, suppose you've managed to get through. Then, and only then, the second gate will be there for you. The Magic Mirror Gate. As I've said, I myself have not been able to observe it. What I tell you has been gleaned from travellers' accounts. This second gate is both open and closed. Sounds crazy, doesn't it? It might be better to say neither closed nor open. Though that doesn't make it any less crazy. The point is that this gate seems to be a big mirror, or something of the kind, though it's made neither of glass nor of metal. What it is made of, no one has ever been able to tell me. Anyway, when you stand before it, you see yourself, but not as you would in an ordinary mirror. You don't see your outward appearance. What you see is your real innermost nature. If you want to go through, you have to, in a manner of speaking, go into yourself.
Well, said Atreyu, it seems to me that this magic mirror gate is easier to get through than the first.
Wrong,
cried Engiwook. Once again, he began to trot back and forth in agitation.
Dead wrong, my friend. I've known travellers who considered themselves absolutely blameless to yelp with horror and run away at the sight of the monster grinning out of the mirror at them. We had to care for some of them for weeks before they were even able to start home.
We,
growled Urgle, who was passing with another bucket.
I keep hearing we. When did you ever take care of anybody?
Engiwook waved her away.
Others, he went on lecturing, appear to have seen something even more horrible, but had the courage to go through. What some saw was not so frightening, but it still cost every one of them an inner struggle. Nothing I can say would apply to all. It's a different experience each time.
Good, said Atreyu. Then at least it's possible to go through this magic mirror gate.
Oh yes, of course it's possible, or it wouldn't be a gate. Where's your logic, my boy?
But it's also possible to go around it, said Atreyu. Or isn't it?
Yes, indeed, said Engiwook. Of course it is. But if you do that, there's nothing more behind it. The third gate isn't there until you've gone through the second. How often do I have to tell you that?
I understand. But what about this third gate?
That's where things get really difficult. Because you see, the no-key gate is closed. Simply closed. And that's that. There's no handle and no doorknob and no keyhole. Nothing. My theory is that this single, hermetically closed door is made of fantastican selenium. You may know that there's no way of destroying, bending, or dissolving fantastican selenium. It's absolutely indestructible.
Then there's no way of getting through?
Not so fast, not so fast, my boy. Certain individuals have got through and spoken with Uyulala, so the door can be opened.
But how?
Just listen. Fantastican selenium reacts to our will. It's our will that makes it unyielding. But if someone succeeds in forgetting all purpose, in wanting nothing at all, to him the gate will open of its own accord.
Atreyu looked down and said in an undertone, If that's the case, how can I possibly get through? How can I manage not to want to get through? Engiwook sighed and nodded and sighed.
Just what I've been saying. The no-key gate is the hardest.
But if I succeed after all, Atreyu asked, will I then be in the Southern Oracle?
Yes, said the gnome.
But who or what is Uyulala?
No idea,
said the gnome, and his eyes sparkled with fury.
None of those who have reached her has been willing to tell me. How can I be expected to complete my scientific work if everyone cloaks himself in mysterious silence? I could tear my hair out, if I had any left. If you reach her, Atreyu, will you tell me? Will you? One of these days my thirst for knowledge will be the death of me, and no one is willing to help.
I beg you, promise you'll tell me.
Atreyu stood up and looked at the great riddle gate, which lay bathed in moonlight.
I can't promise that, Engiwook, he said softly, though I'd be glad to show my gratitude. But if no one has told you who or what Ulyalala is, there must be a reason. And before I know what that reason is, I can't decide whether someone who hasn't seen her with his own eyes has a right to know.
In that case, get away from me, screamed the gnome, his eyes literally spewing sparks. All I get is ingratitude. All my life I wear myself out trying to reveal a secret of universal interest, and no one helps me. I should never have bothered with you.
With that, he ran into the little cave, and a door could be heard slamming within. Ogle passed Atreyu and said with a titter,
The old fool means no harm, but is always running into such disappointments with this ridiculous investigation of his. He wants to go down in history as the one who has solved the great riddle, the world-famous gnome Engiwook. You mustn't mind him.
Of course not, said Atreyu. Just tell him I thank him with all my heart for what he has done for me, and I thank you too. If it's allowed, I will tell him the secret, if I come back.
Then you're leaving us?
Urgal asked. I have to, said Atreyu. There's no time to be lost. Now I shall go to the oracle. Farewell. And in the meantime, take good care of Falkor, the luck dragon.
With that, he turned away and strode toward the great riddle gate. Ogle watched the erect figure with the blowing cloak vanish among the rocks and ran after him, crying,
Lots of luck, Atreyu!
But she didn't know whether he had heard or not. As she waddled back to her little cave, she muttered to herself,
He'll need it all right. He'll need lots of luck.
Atreyu was now within 50 feet of the great stone gate. It was much larger than he had judged from a distance. Behind it lay a deserted plain. There was nothing to stop the eye, and Atreyu's gaze seemed to plunge into an abyss of emptiness. In front of the gate and between the two pillars, Atreyu saw only innumerable skulls and skeletons. All that was left of the varied species of fantasticans who had tried to pass through the gate, but had been frozen forever by the gaze of the sphinxes. But it wasn't these gruesome reminders that stopped Atreyu. What stopped him was the sight of the sphinxes. He had been through a good deal in the course of the great quest. He had seen beautiful things and horrible things. But up until now, he had not known that one and the same creature can be both, that beauty can be terrifying. The two monsters were bathed in moonlight, and as Atreyu approached them, they seemed to grow beyond measure. Their heads seemed to touch the moon, and their expression as they looked at each other seemed to change with every step he took. Currents of a terrible unknown force flashed through the upraised bodies, and still more through the almost human faces. It was as though these beings did not merely exist in the way marble, for instance, exists, but as if they were on the verge of vanishing, but would recreate themselves at the same time. For that very reason, they seemed far more real than anything made of stone. Fear gripped Atreyu. Fear not so much of the danger that threatened him, as of something above and beyond his own self. It hardly grazed his mind that if the Sphinx's gaze should strike him, he would freeze to the spot forever. No, what made his steps heavier and heavier, until he felt as though he were made of cold grey lead, was fear of the unfathomable, of something intolerably vast. Yet he went on. He stopped looking up. He kept his head bowed and walked very slowly, foot by foot, toward the stone gate. Heavier and heavier grew his burden of fear. He thought it would crush him, but still
he went on. He didn't know whether the sphinxes had closed their eyes or not. Would he be admitted? Or would this be the end of his great quest? He had no time to lose in worrying. He just had to take his chances. At a certain point, he felt sure that he had not enough willpower left to carry him a single step forward. And just then, he heard the echo of his footfalls within the great vaulted gate. Instantly, every last shred of fear fell from him, and he knew that whatever might happen, he would never again be afraid. Looking up, he saw that the great riddle gate lay behind him. The sphinxes had let him through. Up ahead, no more than 20 paces away, where previously there had been nothing but the great empty plain, he saw the magic mirror gate. This gate was large and round, like a second moon, for the real moon was still shining high in the sky, and it glittered like polished silver. It was hard to imagine how anyone could pass through a metal surface, but Atreyu didn't hesitate for a moment. After what Engiwook had said, he expected a terrifying image of himself to come toward him out of the mirror. But now that he had left all fear behind him, he hardly gave the matter a thought. What he saw was something quite unexpected, which wasn't the least bit terrifying, but which baffled him completely. He saw a fat little boy with a pale face, a boy his own age, and this little boy was sitting on a pile of mats, reading a book. The little boy had large, sad-looking eyes, and he was wrapped in frayed grey blankets. Behind him, a few motionless animals could be distinguished in the half-light, an eagle, an owl, and a fox. And farther off, there was something that looked like a white skeleton. He couldn't make out exactly what it was. Bastian gave a start when he realized what he had just read. Why, that was him! The description was right in every detail! The book trembled in his hands. This was going too far. How could there be something in a book that applied only to this particular moment and only to him? It could only be a crazy accident, but a very remarkable accident. Bastian, he said aloud, you really are a screwball. Pull yourself together. He had meant to say this very sternly, but his voice quavered a little, for he was not quite sure that what had happened was an accident. Just imagine, he thought, what if they've really heard of me in Fantastica? Wouldn't that be wonderful? But he didn't dare say it aloud. A faint smile of astonishment played over Atreyu's lips as he passed into the mirror image. He was rather surprised that he was succeeding so easily in something that others had found insuperably difficult. But on the way through, he felt a strange, prickly shudder. He had no suspicion of what had really happened to him. But when he emerged on the far side of the magic mirror gate, he had lost all memory of himself, of his past life, aims, and purposes. He had forgotten the great quest that had brought him there, and he didn't even know his own name. He was like a newborn child. Up ahead of him, only a few steps away, he saw the no-key gate. But he had forgotten its name, and forgotten that his purpose in passing through it was to reach the Southern Oracle. He had no idea why he was there or what he was supposed to do. He felt light and cheerful, and he laughed for no reason, for the sheer pleasure of it. The gate he saw before him was as small and low as a common door, and stood all by itself with no walls around it on the empty plain. And this door was closed. Atreyu looked at it for a while. It seemed to be made of some material with a coppery sheen. It was nice to look at, but Atreyu soon lost interest. He went around the gate and examined it from behind, but the back looked no different than the front. There was neither handle, nor knob, nor keyhole. Obviously, This door could not be opened, and anyway, why would anyone want to open it, since it led nowhere and was just standing there? For behind the gate, there was only the wide, flat, empty plain. Atreyu felt like leaving. He turned back, went around the magic mirror gate, and looked at it for some time, without realizing what it was. He decided to go away.
"No! No, don't go away!" said Bastian aloud. "Turn around! You have to go through the no-key gate!"
But then he turned back to the no-key gate. He wanted to look at its coppery sheen again. Once more, he stood in front of the gate, bending his head to the left, bending it to the right, enjoying himself. Tenderly, he stroked the strange material. It felt warm and almost alive. And the door opened by a crack. Atreyu stuck his head through, and then he saw something he hadn't seen on the other side when he had walked around the gate. He pulled his head back, looked past the gate, and saw only the empty plain. He looked again through the crack in the door, and saw a long corridor formed by innumerable huge columns. And farther off, there were stairs and more pillars, and terraces and more stairs, and a whole forest of columns. But none of these columns supported a roof. For above them, Atreyu could see the night sky. He passed through the gate and looked around him with wonderment. The door closed behind him. The clock in the belfry struck 4. Little by little, the murky light was failing. It was getting too dark to read by. Bastian put the book down. What was he to do now? There was bound to be electric light in this attic. He groped his way to the door and ran his hand along the wall, but couldn't find a switch. He looked on the opposite side, and again there was none. He took a box of matches from his trouser pocket. He always had matches on him, for he had a weakness for making little fires. But they were damp, and the first 3 wouldn't light. In the faint glow of the 4th, he tried to locate a light switch, but there wasn't any. The thought of having to spend the whole evening and night here in total darkness gave him the cold shivers. He was no baby, and at home or in any other familiar place he had no fear of the dark. But this enormous attic, with all these weird things in it, was something else again. The match burned his fingers, and he threw it away. For a while he just stood there and listened. The rain had let up, and now he could barely hear the drumming on the big tin roof. Then he remembered the rusty 7-armed candelabrum he had seen. He groped his way across the room, found the candelabrum, and dragged it to his pile of mats. He lit the wicks in the thick stubs, all 7, and a golden light spread. The flames crackled faintly and wavered now and then in the draught. With a sigh of relief, Bastian picked up the book. 7. The Voice of Silence. Gladness buoyed Atreyu's heart as he strode into the forest of columns, which cast black shadows in the bright moonlight. In the deep silence that surrounded him, he barely heard his own footfalls. He no longer knew who he was, or what his name was, how he had got there, or what he was looking for. He was full of wonder, but quite undismayed. The floor was made of mosaic tiles, showing strange ornamental designs or mysterious scenes and images. Atreyu passed over it, climbed broad steps, came to a vast terrace, descended another set of steps, and passed down a long avenue of stone columns. He examined them one after another, and it gave him pleasure to see that each was decorated with different signs and symbols. Farther and farther he went from the no-key gate. At last, when he had gone heaven knows how far, he heard a hovering sound in the distance and stopped to listen. The sound came closer. It was a singing voice, but it seemed very, very sad,
almost like a sob at times. This lament passed over the columns like a breeze, then stopped in one place, rose and fell, came and went, and seemed to move in a wide circle around Atreyu. He stood still and waited. Little by little, the circle became smaller, and after a while he was able to understand the words the voice was singing.
Oh, nothing can happen more than once, but all things must happen one day. Over hill and dale, over wood and stream, my dying voice will blow away.
Atreyu turned in the direction of the voice, which darted fitfully among the columns, but he could see no one.
Who are you? He cried.
The voice came back to him like an echo.
Who are you?
Atreyu pondered.
Who am I? He murmured. I don't know. I have a feeling that I once knew. But does it matter?
The singing voice answered,
If questions you would ask of me, you must speak in poetry. For rhymeless talk that strikes my ear, I cannot hear. I cannot hear.
Atreyu hadn't much practice in rhyming. This would be a difficult conversation, he thought, if the voice only understood poetry. He racked his brains for a while, then he came out with,
I hope it isn't going too far, but could you tell me who you are?
This time the voice answered at once,
I hear you now. Your words are clear. I understand as well as hear.
And then, coming from a different direction, it sang,
I thank you, friend, for your goodwill. I'm glad that you have come to me. I am Uyulala, the voice of silence, in the palace of deep mystery.
Atreyu noticed that the voice rose and fell, but was never wholly silent. Even when it sang no words, or when he was speaking, a sound hovered in the air. For a time it seemed to stand still, then it moved slowly away from him. He ran after it and asked,
O Uyulala, tell me where you're hid. I cannot see you, and so wish I did.
Passing him by, the voice breathed into his ear,
Never has anyone seen me. Never do I appear. You will never see me, and yet I am here.
Then you're invisible? He asked. But when no answer came, he remembered that he had to speak in rhyme, and asked,
Have you no body? Is that what you mean? Or is it only that you can't be seen?
He heard a soft, bell-like sound, which might have been a laugh or a sob. And the voice sang,
Yes and no, and neither one. I do not appear in the brightness of the sun,